You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
All right, we've spent a lot of time having fun. I want to talk about something. Your public persona is a happy, bubbly, fun-loving guy, but you struggled with depression for years. Mm-hmm. What caused you to want to make that struggle public with your book?
Yeah, so, I think I probably fought it for most of my life. I got into alcohol at a very young age, all through high school, all through college, even into my broadcasting career to a point where I was right on the edge of losing my broadcasting career in Minnesota. And so, so I quit for the third time 23 years ago, which I was applauded for. And yet that's how I was self-medicating. I mean, that's how I coped. I wasn't really aware of other ways of medicating. And to be honest, I didn't realize that's what I was using alcohol for. I thought I was just being a young, wild and crazy or whatever, later realizing irresponsible young man, but I didn't realize it had anything to do with self-medicating insecurity or loneliness or anything like that. So on one hand, quitting alcohol was the right thing, and it still was, but now I had to deal with what I had to deal with. I mean, there was no coping with it. And so it built up over years. I mean, moving to Kansas City and being new in town and being lonely and not having a lot of roots added to it. And so it all came to a head in August of 2005, to a point that I realized, I mean, I really can't handle this on my own. So I went into some pretty intense therapy and life coaching, and I was on medication, and Fred, we're talking about Fred, was one of the few people that I talked to about it. He seemed to really understand that there was something going on with me, and I would go into his office sometimes at the stadium, and just with tears coming down my face, and I would just talk to him. He was working in addition to doing the games, he was working with Royals alumni, and he had his own office, and I would go in there, and he would just check in on me a lot. And I think people just began to hear about it in 2005. And in that off season, I mean, I really got after it. I mean, I didn't know if I was going to make it, but I was going to try. And that off season really put me in the hands of a lot of really good, talented people to get my head back on straight and to realize, what had caused my depression, what continued to cause my depression, and, changes I had to make in my life about who I was and how I wanted to live my life and who I wanted to spend my time with. And so I came back to spring training in 06, with a new awareness and feeling better. And I don't know who knew and who didn't know, but I had the feeling that people knew. Mike Sweeney and I, were and are very close. He was aware of what was going on. And so, the Kansas City Star, always did a big baseball spread on opening day. I mean, it was an entirely different sports section. I mean, from cover to cover, it was just all baseball, and they would have a theme every year. And then they would feature different people that fit within that theme. And, so Jeff Passan was working for the Kansas City Star. We were in Arizona, where I'm speaking to you now from my hotel room in Arizona. And Jeff came up to me at spring training and he said, "Hey, we're doing this. This is our theme for this year. And, we want to do a story on one of the broadcasters, and, can we do something with you?" And I said, "Sure." So we went to a restaurant, and, before our interview, Zach Greinke had left the Royals for personal reasons. And he ended up leaving because of depression and social anxiety disorder, or maybe it might've been just depression and anxiety. I don't know. And I mean, it just stunned everybody. Like, Zach Greinke was, going to be on the top of the world here, this young, talented pitcher. And he just left. And Allard Baird came to me because he had heard what I'd gone through and I was getting better. And he was just kind of, how do I handle this? What do you think he's going through? What's the best way to deal with him? And I talked to Zach on the phone a couple of times when he had gone back to Florida. And I think what happened, Dave, is I began to realize that this was going on all around me. And some people were acknowledging their depression. Some people were trying to find ways to avoid it through drugs, alcohol, gambling, being a workaholic, pornography, you know, whatever the vice was, it was some form of depression, some form of feeling inadequate and trying to, you know, to fill it with the wrong thing. So back to Jeff Passan, we go to a restaurant and we're just kind of small talking. And finally he says, he pulls his tape recorder out back when they used tape recorders and he hit record and he just put it on the table and he said, all right, so who is Ryan Lefebvre? And, you know, to that point in my life, I'd done many interviews about, you know, where I'm from and who my influences were and what I hope to accomplish as being a broadcaster. What was my favorite moment to broadcast? You know, blah, 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 blah. And it was almost like a whisper from God, like, here's your opportunity. I have shown you that this is going on all around you. You know, I've allowed you to go through this. I've helped you get through this. I've put the right people in your path. You're doing better. Now, what are you going to do with all this? And I told him the whole story. And I've never asked Jeff this. I will one of these days. I don't know why I haven't. It was so long ago. But I wondered, like, if that was a loaded question. Like, did he know that, or did he just innocently say who is? But I always thought it was interesting. Who is Ryan Lefebvre? And the whole story became about my depression. And he interviewed my mom. He interviewed my life coach. He interviewed Mike Sweeney. I mean, a lot of people that were around me. And I mean, it was a big story in the Kansas City Star. And then it was just out there. And I started getting letters from complete strangers, emails, you know, thank you so much. I mean, that's what I'm going through. And I appreciate you, you know, using your story to help me. And then I started getting a lot of speaking engagements and talk shows wanted me on to try and explain what was going on with Zach Greinke. You know, all of a sudden I became like the poster child for men with depression, because at that time men weren't, you know, there are plenty of players that were depressed and leaving the team, but they'd say, well, he's on the DL because he's got a sore shoulder and he was actually dealing with personal reasons. But, you know, I give Zach credit. You know, he was one of the first that just admitted to what was going on. And so, about a year after that, Jeffrey Flanagan approached me and said, would you be interested in writing a book? And I'm not a writer by nature. I mean, I'm a talker. But I journaled through all of that. And I typed it. I don't know why. Maybe I just didn't want to write, but I would, to help me get through tough days, I would type what I was journaling, or if I had a breakthrough, I would type about it. So Flanny asked me if I wanted to do a book, and I had 225 pages of typed journal entries. And I said, here you go. And that's the book. I mean, I'd say about 90% of what you read are my actual words. Flanny was not a ghostwriter, but what Flanny did, you know, his gift is writing. Obviously Flanny took all my information and he knew what I wrote too much about that needed to be cut down. And then he would say to me, hey, you didn't write enough about this. I need you to write more. This is interesting. You need to write more about it. And I would. And then, you know, maybe I had it in an A, B, C, D sequence. And Flanny thought, you know, well, let's make this, if we make this C, A, B, D, you know, then it, I can make it. I mean, he was, I've always said, like, I was the dancer, but he was the choreographer. You know, he's the one that put all the moves. And yeah, I mean, that was just, you know, the book is still on shelves now. And there's a couple of colleges that use it as a textbook talking about depression. And there's been a lot of books since then on depression, but I think I just recognized that I had, my story, and I'm not being modest when I say this, but there's really nothing special about my story. My story is not unique compared to anyone else's story about depression, but I have a unique platform. I had a unique opportunity to tell my story. And I mean, every time someone comes up to me or writes me a letter or an email or whatever about how they read my book and either it helped them themselves or it helped them understand a loved one that's dealing with depression. I mean, that's why I wrote the book. I mean, I knew I wasn't going to be on Oprah Winfrey or the New York Times bestseller list, but if somebody could use my story, just like I used other people's stories for inspiration, then, you know, it was all worth it to me.
Did it help you with you dealing with it yourself? The fact of getting it out there, you understand what I'm asking?
I think, you know, the turning point, there was a turning point. We were in Toronto at the end of the 05 season. And I think the season actually ended in Toronto that year. So it was the end of the year. And I started on medication in early September. And I still felt lousy at the end of September. And my fear was that the medication wasn't going to work. And this is just how I was going to feel. I mean, this was it. And I remember vividly one day going for a run in Toronto. You know, I was exercising a lot more back then. And I used to run. And I mean, I remember just sprinting through Toronto, just running. I mean, somehow I had this just adrenaline rush. And it was as if the depression was following me no matter what happened. You know, if I had a good day, then the next day wasn't good. You know, it just wouldn't go away. And I literally was like, okay, I'm going to outrun you today. I'm going to lose you in the streets of Toronto. And getting back to the room and, you know, just feeling exhilarated and exhausted after that run. And, you know, like an hour later, I just felt as bad as I ever felt. And going to bed one night, and it was the first time that I don't want to say I planned suicide, but I thought seriously about it. Not right then, but I began to realize, you know what? And I reference this in the book. You remember the movie Lethal Weapon? Mm-hmm. And it begins with that really dramatic scene. Mel Gibson's, he's depressed. I think it's the anniversary of his wife's passing, and he's intoxicated. He's got a gun and he puts the gun. I mean, it's a really dramatic scene and he chooses not to do it and all that. And I started to realize, you know, I don't think that's how it happens. I think people just check out and just say, I'm done. You know, I'm not doing this anymore. It's not, mental illness is certainly attached to it. Don't get me wrong, but I think there's a piece of mind that goes with it in that I give up, I surrender, I want out. That's not always the case, but I mean, I remember thinking, so this is how it goes down. I mean, you just realize, like, you know what? I have a choice. I don't have to do this anymore. Mm. And I had a friend, a high school teammate named Sean Fitzpatrick who took his life after he went to college, and he left a note. And the note said that he didn't want to do it anymore. And he wanted to go be with God. And I thought, you know, that they miss him and it was tragic, but that's what he wanted to do. And I remember lying there thinking, well, you know, I have other options if this doesn't get any better. And again, I go back to those little whispers from God, and within 2 minutes of thinking there's a way out if I can't get better, I also got this whisper of, but if you do get through this, you could help somebody else. You can use your story. You can use all of these awful experiences that you've had and all these awful feelings that you've had, and you can share this with somebody else. And I got up the next day, and it was the last game of the season. And I'm kind of putting the pieces of the story back together, and I got to Sky Dome, now Rogers Center. And I was having just a terrible day. I mean, I got to the stadium really early, and I remember there was a, it's turning into a long story, sorry, but there was a high school championship game going on the big league field before the actual game. They must've started early in the morning. And I just got there and I just walked laps around the concourse just over and over and over. I just had to keep moving. And I remember, of course, you know, I'm looking down there at all these kids and I'm thinking, boy, these kids have their whole lives in front of them. And I hope they make better choices than I did. And then I got up to the booth and did the game with Split. And I mean, I just was just just get me through this game. And I wrote about, I wrote a lot about this last experience. Get me back to Kansas City. And I just want to go get in my bed at my house. I was single, living alone, and I can just go to sleep for a month. You know, I mean, just get me out of here. And you know, I woke up the next day and I felt better. And then I felt a little bit better after that. And so yes, that realization of I can use this. I can take something that was awful and I can use this for good. You know, and I've said many times that that experience was the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And it was the best thing that's ever happened to me.
I appreciate you not only writing the book and sharing that and going public back in the mid 2000s, but I appreciate you sharing it with us today on the podcast. Cause that it takes courage to, for lack of a better, it takes courage to say, I'm not perfect. You know, people expect us in the public eye to be perfect. And if we're not perfect, just to push it aside. So being willing to talk about that, I appreciate that very much. I do want to wrap up here. Sure. With things that I know, I mean, not that that's a negative thing, but you know, you talked about it was the worst thing and the best thing. I want to talk to you about the best thing, even better than turning things around. Talk about Sarah and your kids. First of all, are your boys future broadcasters or are they future baseball players? And just talk about what they mean to you now.
Yeah. So Sarah and I were friends for 4.5 years before we started dating. She worked at the stadium. You probably remember Sarah in the dining room before the configuration. While she was the reconfiguration, she was going through nursing school, and she worked as a server on the plaza for a group that also coincidentally catered the stadium. Not the concession stands, but the media dining room where you and I used to eat and all of the suites. And she's not a sports fan at all. And she just said, no, I'm not going out to the stadium. I don't care about sports. You know, I don't want to do it. And her boss kept saying, please, you know, I really would like you to come out to the stadium. And so she finally gave in, and that's where we first met in 2003. And so she was at the stadium 2003, 2004. We were friends only for 3 years. And then the year and a half after that, we became really good friends, really best friends. And so, we started dating in October of 2007. We got engaged in December of 2007 and we got married in February of 2008.
Wow.
So in 4 months, we went from friends to married, and I wouldn't recommend that. We had to navigate through some stuff our first year of marriage because of that. But I mean, I truly, you know, I always wanted to marry my best friend, and I did. And my book comes out toward the end of our first year of marriage, and she was thinking back about where she was in 2005, and we were friends, and I didn't tell her what was going on. I mean, we weren't that close at the time. But a neat story about, you know, being brought together for a purpose is that she and her roommate in the summer of 2005 and her best friend, Alyssa, they both wanted to be married, and they wanted to marry, you know, a good man like, you know, every woman should, and a good godly man. And they decided to spend that summer praying for their future husbands, even though they didn't know who their future husbands were, and praying that they would get through whatever they're getting through in life. And that when they met each other, that they'd be ready for marriage and all that. And we found out that when I was going through that whole summer, that even though we were friends and she knew me, she didn't know I was her husband someday, but she was praying for me that whole summer, even though she didn't realize that it was me that she was praying for. And so, so then we have 4 kids. Micah, who just turned 11, he's probably the closest to being a broadcaster. I mean, he's a talker. I mean, he's been very articulate, you know, since a very young age. All of our kids are 20 and a half months apart. I mean, almost to the day. I mean, we always joke that Sarah had a super egg every 20 and a half months because they are literally all 20 and a half months apart. But, and then Evan is 9. he's our complex one. He's our most passionate one. He loves passionately and he hates passionately. Lucas is our third son. He's seven and he's our little worker. I mean, he just, if I'm doing something, I mean, he wants to help out whatever chore or project I'm doing around the house. We live on 10 acres and we have a couple of horses and we have barn cats and we have ducks and we have a dog and there's always something to do on 10 acres. Let me tell you, when I'm out there with a chainsaw or working in the pasture or something like that, I mean, Lucas is the one that he wants to go to work. And then our baby is our 5-year-old daughter named Callie. And, I love my boys with all my heart. And I can't imagine what it would be like not being the father of a little girl. I mean, and you know, she came last, you know, when we thought we were just going to have boys. And so, and you know, a part of this job that I hate is that, you know, I'm away from them so much. And, you know, the pandemic was what it was. And, you know, the loss of life and the loss of jobs and income and, you know, I always want to be careful not using the word blessing because I know how painful it's been for other families. But many of us had to go on with our lives somehow. And me being home all those months was time that, you know, we've never had together. We'll probably never have together again.
Yeah.
Out of it, we've decided to homeschool our kids and have even and more time with them. So Sarah and I are just trying to get through that, you know, pretending to be homeschoolers. And, you know, we've got another baseball season on the horizon here. And I know there will be, you know, when I start traveling again, you know, I love it. It's a tremendous privilege to be, you know, literally the medium between the fans and the players and just trying to share the players with the fans. And I can tell you, David, there's many times on the road that I just stare out the window and ask myself, you know, is this really what I'm supposed to be doing, you know, with my family home and not me being with them? So I love them very much. And I hope that, you know, that as I continue in this career, that my job will be a blessing and not a burden to them.
You mentioned, you know, you love your three boys, but it's totally different. I've had a theory because I've got one of each. My son is older, and when my daughter came, and she's 35 now, so I've had experience with this. Fathers have sons and little girls, and mothers have daughters and little boys. And if you don't understand the difference, you don't have one of each. But my little girl, who's now 35 and has two little girls of her own, she's got me wrapped around her little finger. She can do no wrong. My son and I locked horns because we're so similar. If I criticize my son to my wife, she defends her little boy at 30, and he's 37, you know? So there is definitely a difference. So I appreciate that.
That's the same in our house.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. I'll wrap up, and we've spent way more time than I promised you, but I appreciate
that's okay. That's because I was talking too much. That's why.
No, it's fine. I always like to ask people this question as we wrap up. You're a long way from retirement, long way from being done. But when you retire, what do you hope your legacy is?
As a broadcaster?
You answer it however you want, my friend.
Isn't there another, there's another version of that story, you know, what do you want your tombstone to say? You know, what is, if you're going to sum up someone's life, you know, what's it going to say?
What's the dash?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think, you know, I go back to that wild card game experience about, you know, I was so being tied up into my career and who I was and, you know, as I get older, I turn 50 this year and I know that's not a, you know, an old age, but it's a number that causes reflection. It's different from 40 and 30. I mean, it's, and I think, you know, I mean, I guess the easiest and simplest answer is I think when it's all said and done, you know, I hope that you know, I hope that I was a good husband. And I hope that I was a good father. And then if there's room on there, you know, to say that, that I was a good broadcaster, you know, that's fine. But, you know, I want to be welcome. I want to be welcome through the gates when my time's up. And I don't think Peter's going to say, boy, that was a great call you had in the wild card game.
He's probably not going to bring up Jorge Julio Junior.
No, I don't think so either. No. You know, and I say that tongue in cheek, but I also mean it very seriously. I mean, when it's all said and done, I mean, what is, you know, some recorded calls of big games. I mean, is that going to be a legacy, or is it, you know, kids and grandkids that are making a difference in the world? And then when they speak about their influence, they mention their father or their grandfather. I mean, I think that's a real legacy.
All right. Well, that's a great way to wrap up. It is always good to catch up with you. I think four of the most beautiful words in the English language when put in a certain order is pitchers and catchers report. it means that baseball is on the way. My favorite sport is probably football. But as my friend Dick Enberg used to say, when I asked him one time, I got to know him really well, and he did so many different things. I said, what's your favorite sport? He said, what season is it?
Yeah.
But there is something special about the start of baseball because, you know, hope springs eternal. Use whatever baseball cliche you want. There's something special about baseball. And when I'm getting to talk to Ryan Lefevre, it is great because baseball's here. Whether we see each other at the stadium or we're talking on the phone or whatever, you speak baseball to me and I love it. So I appreciate your time. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule. And it's always great to catch up with you.
All right. Thank you, David. And I look forward to seeing you at Kauffman Stadium this summer.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smail. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smail and his work by visiting davidsmailbooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.